So we move. My husband starts telecommuting for his job. We move our 3-year-old and our 5-year-old. We're here. We're settled. All we need to do is build a spacecraft, test it, launch it, and fly it 3 billion miles to Pluto.
Join us for stories of impossible things. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
You can hear The Moth Fridays at 1 p.m. right here on WAMC.
I wrote a long introduction for Keith Olbermann, and I could read it, but I don't want to read it because then that takes away the time that we actually have to speak with Keith Olbermann. So I'm just going to say Keith Olbermann is on our show, and we're very excited. He has a brand new book called Trump is Effing Crazy. This is Not a Joke. It is published by Blue Rider Press. You know Keith Olbermann. He's been around forever. He's been on MSNBC. He's been on ESPN. He's one of our great broadcasters, commentators, reporters, writers, and it's a great pleasure to have him on our program this morning. How are you, sir?
I'm good, sir. Thank you for the kind words.
Well, it's very nice to have you with us. You know, the last time I saw you, I was talking to you about your shingles backstage at David Letterman on Joan Rivers' last appearance on that program. This morning. So you now are doing GQ commentaries, and this is fascinating because I don't know that I've ever seen you as angry as you are right now. I'm almost worried about you.
Well, I think we haven't seen this kind of president before, and I mean in the history of this country and probably in the history of Western democracy. So there's good reason to be angry, and I think it's necessary. And it's not a performance. It's watching. All the things that I was ever suggested we needed to protect in the democracy be just sheared off one by one, and probably merits no response.
And a longtime veteran journalist, one of the highest echelons, say to me the other day, we knew it was going to be bad. Nobody knew it was going to be this bad. Would you agree with that?
No, I think this is one of the more interesting parts of putting this book together, which was, look, I wrote each piece here with minor adaptation from the GQ commentaries. I wrote them all myself and rewrote them and went over with fact checkers and producers and editors to make sure we had the facts therein nailed. And I put the book together and worked with an editor on which pieces to leave in and which ones to cut out. And then I sat down to read the audio version of it, which is 16 hours long and took about a week and a half to do. And I had forgotten about 40 to 50% of the things that had gotten me so angry, because obviously the other element of uniqueness to this man is the sheer volume of material and controversy and insanity that he produces. And it was at the same time, disconcerting to realize that there'd been so much that I was actually letting things slip out one side of my head, and yet reassuring that no, we did see a lot of this coming, and maybe the people who were opposed to it now did not take it as seriously as they should have. And I was reflecting, because we included this in the book, I gave a speech to a group of Democrats and liberals in Florida the night before the inauguration. And I was out there giving them the red meat and meet me at the barricades and the rest of that. And even then, I was surprised at the other speakers who were talking about, we need more retail politics and we need to go door to door. We need to talk more to the steel worker in Michigan about his future. And I was like, the whole place is on fire. They were not really willing to accept that, and I think that's the idea that many people believe we didn't see this coming or were not warned is part of the problem, and the response to it, even to my mind, is tepid, particularly from Democrats and liberals, elected Democrats and liberals, I should say, not the rank and file, who I think get this completely, but there's the media has still is still hoping against hope that there's going to be a pivot, that there's going to be normality, and none of this is the case. The place is completely on fire.
So I want to talk about that in just a second, but this notion you have of what I find to be refreshing is because there does become this normalization where, oh, it's another day in Trump land, and, oh, he said this, mm-hmm. and he said that, and this is what he's doing to the families of fallen soldiers. And there seems to be, here's another day. And then I go to my feed, and there you are just screaming about it. And I think, well, why aren't more people just screaming about it? Why aren't we in the streets screaming about it?
Well, there are two main groups to point a finger at and ask why aren't they screaming about it. One is obviously, as I suggested, the Democrats and the liberals, and there's still such a desire to pretend that this isn't a terrible milestone in our history,
right,
in which the democratic system and the protections of the Constitution have failed. And who wants to admit to that? It's as daunting a task as what will have to be done to the people and involving the people who support Trump. They have to climb down not only from the positions that he believes in, that are some of the darkest impulses in man, let alone in this country, but we have to also wait for them to acknowledge they made a mistake and bet on the wrong guy. And that's a very difficult thing to do. But also we have to say, no, democracy has in large part failed. What do we do about it? How do we respond to it? Why are we not in the streets? I mean, we started in the streets. The Women's March was glorious and set the tone. And it was, you're not going to get away with this crap. And we need a Women's March or the equivalent at least once a month. And we're not getting it because there's always we have to have a committee. We have to have a meeting. We have to have a focus group. And that gets into the media's representation here. The media and, to some degree, as I suggested, the Democrats are trying to leverage their own positions. It's like, well, let's not really declare that Trump might be nuts because we might alienate those Trump viewers who are still our data suggests we're still 11% Trump supporters are watching us here at CNN or wherever. And when MSNBC is hiring conservatives in hopes of getting Trump viewers, you know that management of cable news operations really are not rooted in reality anymore. They're not watching. They're not going to watch. And if you think they're watching, you're mistaken about it. But the media, in a larger sense, although great work has been done at the grassroots level of reporting, the work of people who are checking out the Daniel Dales and the David Farenthals and the rest of them who are doing such great work on line by line vetting everything that Trump does and every lie that he's told. For every good piece of work being done there, there's somebody in management at every media operation essentially saying, well, we've never seen this before, therefore it couldn't possibly be true. We couldn't have a crazy president. It's not within the realm of possibility. We couldn't have an election actually interfered with by another government. We can't have that. It's never happened before. I've used this analogy a couple of times. In sports reporting, I always went, and everybody in every press box always goes, half anticipating that they're going to see something that has never happened before. It's one of the mantras of baseball. Go to a baseball game, you will at least see a sequence of events that has never happened before.
Right.
And that's part of the charm, and that's what you're prepared for. In political writing and political reporting of all kinds, it's as if, well, no, I'm going to squeeze this so it fits into a story I wrote, a version of this in 1998. And it's not, there are no previous versions to stick this into. This is, the only parallels to this presidency are in the works of fiction, from 7 days in May to It Can't Happen Here to the Manchurian Candidate. And this, the media will not recognize this because to me, most of the political writers that I have encountered, most of the commentators, most of the columnists are convinced that if it wasn't something that Tom Wicker could have written about in 1968, it can't possibly happen.
Well, I agree with you entirely, but and you seem to reference this in the book too, that it also seems though that there was just this assumption that if you let this guy go long enough during the campaign, he would flame out and would go away. And we're sort of seeing the same mm-hmm. thing now. And hey, we're almost a year into this, and guess what? We're still here. Meaning we're still in the same situation, which I would agree with you is a very dangerous, scary situation.
Well, and there are Democratic leaders who are sitting there doing the equivalent of what I just referenced relative to the media. There are people who are sitting there and suggesting, how do we best position ourselves relative to Trump for the midterms? In other words, do we run on an anti-Trump platform, or do we do the, and my argument was, and it was in this speech on the eve of the inauguration, your platform is secondary, just as your premise of how much money you're going to make at your television network or your newspaper needs to be secondary. The question is, what do you need to do for the sake of your country right now? Is there a true crisis about democracy, about its viability going forward, about the mental health of the president? Are these things actually happening, and what are you doing about them as Americans? I saw a promotional thing, I've seen it a dozen times at least, a day on one of the few television networks that I watch any news from, which is BBC World News. And in it, the one of the announcers explains that the BBC can be trusted because they've never taken a side in any election or debate or war. And I was just thinking, you didn't take a side at the BBC when the Germans were bombing your office in 1940. Seriously, you didn't take a side? We often have to take sides.
Yeah.
In real life, people have to take sides every hour of every day. If you are going to sit there and focus group the future of the country, well, no, see, here are the advantages of crypto fascism, and if it came to this country, it's a very good market. It might help the stock market too. Standard and Poor's says that it deserves an A-minus rating. This is madness. I mean, if we had been invaded by another country, we would be, in fact, reporters and Democrats and focus group leaders alike, we'd all be out there trying to expel the invaders. And that needs to be done now. So that's my job, is to sit there and go, hey, what are you people doing? The building is on fire.
Now, we only have 30 seconds, but in that time, as you say, the platform is secondary. And not to minimize the great work you do on the GQ mm-hmm. web series, but why don't you have a show? You should have a show. So shouldn't you have a show? Shouldn't you be on?
Well, yeah, but I'd be saying things I say now. I was offered a show on MSNBC in 2015, a third time through that organization, on the premise that I not do any commentaries.
Oh, well, that's
so you
that's
can imagine
stupid.
What was the purpose of that? That to me, I read that as, we don't want you to do commentaries. In fact, we want to make sure you can't do commentaries.
But everybody on that network is doing commentaries now.
Well, to be fair, they were all my former guest hosts, except the one in the afternoon who's my former girlfriend. So you're getting the B team. Sorry about that. And you cannot say the things that I'm saying on national television.
Well, you know what I love about you, though? Go ahead. No.
The reach of these things, essentially the average viewership of these video commentaries is 2 million each, which is comparable to what's being done on cable news anyway.
True.
And I don't have to work full-time and interview movie stars if I don't want to as a sideline, or have on a Republican guest. So I like this operation pretty nicely.
Well,
it's worked out okay, and the reach is pretty good.
I love that you're not bitter.
Well, it's not. My bitterness is I am bitter, but I'm bitter about where the media has failed us, where the networks have failed us, and the idea that there's still some good. It's the same argument that Trump made. Well, there are good people on both sides. It's like, no. Once you're standing there with a bunch of Nazis, you're no longer a good person. Sorry.
All right. We are horribly over time, because now if I'm so late, we're going to miss the BBC broadcast. So the book is Trump is Effing Crazy. This is not a joke. It is published by Blue Rider Press. Keith Olbermann, I could talk to you for another hour, but we have to go hear British people give the news. Thank you very much
Just
for
remember,
being with
they
us.
They didn't take sides against Hitler when he was bombing them. Take care.
Keith Olbermann, ladies and gentlemen. Brian Shields is next.